This episode is based on a chapter from Laws of Life, Book 1, Ditch the System, Design Your Life by Jax Burko.
And it is a really intense one today.
It really is. So, welcome to this deep dive. Today, our whole mission is to completely rewire how you, the listener, repair trust and, you know, handle your mistakes.
Right.
Because we are looking squarely at Chapter 8's core law. And that law states, when you are wrong, apologize for what you did, not how you made the other person feel.
That distinction right there, what you did versus how they feel, it's just a profound shift in perspective. And honestly, it's a completely necessary one.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in my practice as a conflict resolution coach, I'm sitting down every day with families, couples, workplace teams, and they're just, well, drowning in unresolved resentment.
Yeah, I bet.
And I see the immense damage of poorly constructed apologies constantly.
Mm-hmm.
People think they're fixing things, right? Mm-hmm. But they're actually just deepening the wound.
And I see the exact same dynamic from the corporate side. Working as a leadership trainer, I spend my days teaching managers and small business owners how to correct performance and, you know, own their own missteps.
Right, which is not easy.
No, it's not. The absolute number one stumbling block across the board is accountability. I mean, people will do almost anything to avoid taking clean, unmitigated ownership of a failure.
Yeah. It's human nature, I guess. But before we really get into the mechanics of this, we need to clarify a crucial caveat that the author establishes right early on.
Yes, very important.
This law about apologizing for actions rather than feelings, it does not mean you get to just dismiss the other person's emotions.
Right.
It doesn't mean you ignore the harm you've caused, and it definitely doesn't mean you avoid making things right. It is strictly about taking operational ownership of your own actions.
Precisely.
But, you know, if we pull back and look at that, it raises a really natural question. I hear this from clients all the time. Well, if we aren't apologizing for someone's feelings, aren't we just acting like unfeeling robots? Like, where is the empathy?
It's a completely valid concern, but there is a massive psychological difference between atoning for an emotional injury versus taking absolute operational accountability for your actions.
Okay, unpack that a little.
So atoning means you deeply care about the damage, right? Accountability means you own the hammer that caused the damage.
Ooh, that's a great way to put it.
Yeah, and if you focus your apology on the other person's feelings, you're subtly shifting the spotlight, you know? Mm. You're making their emotional reaction the central issue rather than the fact that you swung the hammer recklessly.
Which means we really have to unlearn an incredibly toxic habit because society has completely normalized the fake apology.
Oh, man. Have they ever?
We are surrounded by models of how not to apologize, primarily from the media.
We see it every time we turn on the news. There's the sharp contrast between a genuine, you know, blue-collar, hat-in-hand apology where someone just owns their failure and the highly manicured, PR-driven non-apologies from politicians and celebrities.
Oh, yeah, the classic spin doctor approach.
Exactly.
The entire goal is to sound contrite without ever actually admitting actionable guilt. It's basically a liability shield masquerading as regret.
And there's a fascinating psychological dynamic as to why those fake apologies actually work in the public sphere, which the text points out. It's modern tribalism.
Right.
And this applies across the board, regardless of political affiliation. A politician's supporters will eagerly accept a half-baked, spin-doctored apology because they are already invested in that team winning.
They just need enough cover to keep supporting their side.
Exactly. Meanwhile, their political opponents wouldn't accept a sincere, heartfelt apology anyway. They want blood, not reconciliation.
So the incentive structure for a public figure is completely warped. Their fans giving them a pass. Their haters are going to hate them regardless. So, you know, why assume legal or social liability?
Right. Covering your tracks works perfectly fine in a polarized public arena.
But, and this is the big but, if you bring that cynical defensive strategy into your real world relationships, your marriage, your friendships, your business partnerships, it will utterly destroy trust.
It really will.
In the real world. As this chapter's blue-collar ethos really hammers home, your word is your only true currency.
Yeah.
A real apology requires vulnerability. Shoulders back, hat in hand, stating, I screwed up, it's my fault, and I will make it right.
And to understand how to do that, we have to recognize what a fake apology sounds like in our daily lives. The chapter highlights a few classic blame-shifting phrases that most of us use without even realizing how destructive they are.
Oh, I hear these all the time.
Let's look at the first one. I'm sorry if anyone was hurt.
The word if does an incredible amount of heavy lifting there.
It really does.
By inserting if, you are implying that the hurt is hypothetical, or maybe even an overreaction. It completely removes the certainty of your action. You aren't saying you caused harm. You're saying harm might have theoretically occurred somewhere in the vicinity of your actions.
Exactly. And then you have the classic corporate evasion, right? I'm sorry you felt that I did something wrong. Or I'm sorry you were offended.
Oh, I hate that one.
Right. Because you aren't apologizing for your action at all. You are apologizing for their perception. You are essentially telling them, I am sorry your brain is too fragile to interpret my perfectly fine behavior correctly.
Yes. It shifts the entire burden of the conflict onto the other person's emotional state.
Exactly.
And then we reach the ultimate relationship killer. The phrase that will instantly escalate any argument.
Lay it on us.
I'm sorry, but.
Oh, man. The word but is an eraser.
It is.
The moment you say but, you delete everything that came before it. You instantly turn the apology into a negotiation over blame.
And, you know, in family conflict coaching, this is exactly where couples get hopelessly stuck. Because they face a very real dilemma. What if the other person started it?
Right.
What if they are undeniably, objectively also to blame for how the situation escalated? It feels deeply unjust to just own your part without addressing the mitigating circumstances.
It feels unjust because our egos demand a defense.
Yeah.
But the rule here in the book is unyielding. You are not a defense attorney in a court of law asking a judge for leniency based on mitigating factors.
Right.
You can only speak for your own actions. If you say, I'm sorry I yelled, but you were ignoring me, you have just told the other person that their action forced your reaction.
You stripped away your own agency.
Exactly. You are claiming you had no choice but to yell, which means you aren't actually sorry for yelling. You're just mad they made you do it.
Grown adults have to act like grown adults, which means worrying exclusively about your own screw-ups. I always tell my clients to think about how a parent handles two siblings fighting.
Oh, that's a good analogy.
Right. One kid hits the other and immediately points a finger, yelling, "But he took my toy." What does the parent say?
I don't care what he did.
Exactly. I don't care what he did. We are talking about what you did. As adults, we somehow completely forget this basic principle.
We really do.
The fact that the words, I'm sorry, are coming out of your mouth means you messed something up. Your apology must be exclusively about your mistake.
And when you actually execute a clean apology, no excuses, no defense attorney, posturing thuck, something incredible happens to the interpersonal dynamics.
Yeah, the shift is wild.
People are so deeply conditioned to expect nonsense, to expect that blame shift, that when you apologize cleanly, they physically brace themselves. They are waiting for the butt to drop.
In mediation, we call it the standoff.
Standoff.
Yeah, it's like both parties have their emotional shields up, weapons drawn.
Yeah.
When you deliver a clean apology, I messed up, I handled that poorly, and I was wrong, and then you just stop talking.
Yeah.
The silence catches them off guard.
Oh, for sure.
It's like putting down your weapon first. It takes a few seconds for their brain to process that no attack is coming. The but never arrives.
Exactly. You break their internal script. And when their emotional shields finally drop, most reasonable people will eventually realize their own role in the conflict.
Right. Because they're not on the defensive anymore.
Exactly. Because they don't have to spend their mental energy defending themselves against your excuses. They actually have the space to reflect on their own actions. Often they will reciprocate with an apology of their own. But you have to be willing to disarm first.
Okay, so we've mapped out how to drop the shield and own your mistakes when you share the blame. But this brings us to a much harder boundary that the chapter discusses.
Yes, the boundary.
What happens when you aren't wrong? Like, what do you do when you acted correctly or reasonably, but the other person is still visibly deeply upset?
You hold the line. You should never apologize when you are right, just to manage someone else's emotions or to ease the tension in the room.
Even though it's so tempting.
It is. Easing tension feels good in the moment, but it creates a disastrous long-term dynamic.
To explore the mechanics of this, the chapter provides three distinct real-world examples of hurt feelings versus actual wrongdoing.
Right.
Let's start with the first one, the author's grandson.
Right. So the grandson is 14 years old. He breaks a clearly established rule and a consequence is issued. The grandson's feelings are genuinely hurt, and he expects an apology because in his mind, feeling bad means someone must have wronged him.
Right. And the author's response is incredibly direct here. He tells the teenager, I'm not sorry. You broke a rule. You knew the consequence. I have nothing to apologize for.
Yeah, he completely refuses to manage the boy's emotions for him.
And the result? The 14-year-old processes it, owns his choice, and moves on. And the author's point is, if a teenager can handle that level of emotional accountability, adults certainly possess the capacity to do the same.
Absolutely. And the second example shifts from a family dynamic to public communication, and it deals with the concept of offense.
Yes, this one is pretty provocative.
It is. The author uses a controversial word, specifically the word retarded, on his podcast to describe a 17-year-old doing something objectively foolish, like eating a Tide Pod.
Right, that internet trend.
Yeah. And he receives hate mail from listeners claiming the word is highly offensive to mentally challenged individuals, and they demand an apology.
So how does he handle that? Because the text outlines a very specific framework for his refusal to apologize.
He does. He asks these angry listeners if they use that word to describe their own mentally challenged loved ones, and they always answer no.
Okay.
So his viewpoint is that he is using a specific dictionary definition to describe a foolish act, and he is not directing it at their loved ones or using it as a slur against the disabled. Therefore, he argues, unless he is speaking directly to them or their group, they are responsible for their own feelings about the words he chooses to use.
Right. And to be clear, we are simply analyzing the framework provided in the chapter impartially here. But the underlying mechanism he's pointing out is clear. Just because someone experiences the emotion of being offended, it does not automatically dictate that a wrong was committed requiring an apology.
Exactly. You are not responsible for how the general public interprets your vocabulary.
Which brings us to the third example, and this one applies directly to the workplace. A leader sits down to give a tough, highly critical performance review. The employee, a grown adult, starts crying, visibly distressed, and clearly expects an apology to soften the blow of their hurt feelings.
And, you know, in a corporate environment, the pressure to just say, I'm sorry right there to stop the tears is immense.
I bet. I hear this from managers constantly. Isn't it just easier to say sorry to keep the peace?
It feels like the empathetic thing to do. But if you apologize when you are simply holding a standard, you destroy the meaning of the standard. In the example from the book, the leader does not apologize.
What does he do?
He waits quietly for the emotion to pass and then delivers the clear message. Get your performance up or find a new career.
Wow.
If you apologize to ease the tension, you are training that employee that their emotional reaction can successfully dictate and soften your leadership behavior.
And this transitions perfectly into the broader concept of lifestyle design. Apologizing properly and refusing to apologize when you shouldn't isn't just a communication tactic. It fundamentally trains the people around you. It creates a reputation.
It does. Holding this line takes intense discipline, but consistency builds a specific kind of respect. The chapter actually references a concept from Machiavelli regarding leadership.
Oh, Machiavelli. Yeah.
Yeah, the idea is that those who are kind when they should be cruel will eventually be forced to be cruel when they should have been kind.
So how does that play out in a modern business scenario?
The author gives a prime example of running a company right before a major economic recession. They had a group of poor performing recruiters. Mm. The nice thing to do would be to accept their excuses, apologize for pushing them too hard, and just let them coast.
Keep the peace.
Right. Instead, the leadership put them on a brutal, demanding training program. Most of those recruiters watched out and quit, and it felt cruel at the time.
Sure.
But by cutting the dead weight and demanding excellence early on, the company saved enough capital to keep the rest of the high-performing staff employed when the recession actually hit.
Wow. So if they hadn't been cruel and held the line early on, they would have had to be truly cruel later by laying off good, hardworking people.
Exactly. Every single interaction trains people how to treat you.
You are constantly teaching people what you will accept, what you will own, and how they are allowed to treat you. Which brings us to a concept in the chapter that sounds, frankly, completely triggering at first glance.
Oh, the dog analogy.
Yes. But it is actually a masterclass in empathy. The rule is, treat people like a dog when you apologize to them.
It certainly grabs your attention.
It does. But the underlying psychology is brilliant. Think about it. When you watch a disaster, movie buildings are collapsing, aliens are attacking, who do you root for the hardest?
The dog. Always the dog.
You root for the dog. We have this deep instinctive love for dogs because of their pure, uncalculated nature.
Yeah.
So how does that translate into apologizing to a human being?
Well, think about the mechanics of stepping on your dog's foot in the kitchen.
Right.
What actually happens? The dog yelps. What do? You immediately drop down, pet the dog, and say you're sorry. You offer pure comfort.
Yeah, of course.
What you don't do is lecture the dog.
Right.
You don't say, I'm sorry I stepped on your foot, but honestly, you know you shouldn't be standing right behind me when I'm cooking.
I mean, if you are delivering a blame-shifting lecture to a golden retriever, you probably need more help than a deep dive can provide.
Exactly. The dog doesn't understand your vocabulary, but they instantly process your tone and your energy. They know the harm was an accident, and they feel your genuine regret.
They usually lean in and try to comfort you in return.
Right. So the question becomes, why do we withhold that pure, unlecturing empathy from our spouses, our business partners, and our friends? Why do we feel this overwhelming compulsion to lecture a human being while we are supposedly apologizing to them?
It really just comes down to ego and vulnerability.
Yep.
Offering pure comfort without a lecture requires you to be entirely vulnerable, to sit in the discomfort of being wrong.
Yeah.
And the human ego hates vulnerability, so it uses the lecture as a defense mechanism to regain status in the conversation.
That's perfectly said.
When you treat a person like a dog in an apology, you are actively choosing to bypass your own ego. You strip away the lecture, you strip away the context, and you just offer pure ownership.
But, you know, bypassing the ego in the heat of the moment is incredibly difficult.
Oh, yeah.
When adrenaline is flowing during an argument, your prefrontal cortex, the logical part of your brain, just shuts down. Your ego takes the wheel, screaming at you to justify your actions and protect your status.
So to stop that from happening, you need a mental interrupt. You need a tool so simple that you can deploy it in 2 seconds before you open your mouth and completely ruin the apology.
And the chapter provides that exact tool. It's called the OWN method. OWN.
Right. And I love the brevity of it. Why is a 3-step method necessary? It sounds so simple.
Well, the beauty of the OWN method is its brevity. If it were a complex 10-step psychological framework, it would be useless during a real fight because of that ego override we just talked about.
Makes total sense. Let's walk through the mechanics of it. The O stands for own exactly what you did.
This requires active, plain language. You state clearly and precisely what your action was. No vague wording, no passive voice.
Right.
You do not say mistakes were made or things got out of hand. You say, I made this mistake or I lost my temper. Make the action unmistakably yours.
Perfect. Then the W stands for without excuse or deflection.
This is where the ego fights back the hardest.
It really does.
You cannot justify the action. You cannot soften it with context to make yourself look slightly better. And most importantly, you cannot shift even 1% of the blame onto the other person. Your apology exists in a vacuum, completely independent of their behavior.
And finally, the N stands for now make it right.
Because words mean nothing without behavioral change. You have to back the apology with a tangible action. Often, making it right isn't about buying a gift. It's about breaking a deeply ingrained bad habit that caused the problem in the first place.
And the author shares a highly practical physical hack for this. He realized he had a habit of intuitively completing other people's sentences.
Oh, I know people like that.
Right. And to him, it felt like active listening. But to everyone else, it felt like he was constantly interrupting and disrespecting them.
Yeah, that's incredibly annoying.
It is. So once he owned the mistake, he needed a way to make it right. So he put a rubber band on his wrist. Every time he looked at it or took it off to shower, it served as a physical neurological reminder. Keep your mouth shut and let people finish speaking.
That's brilliant.
He owned the action, offered zero excuses, and implemented a physical system to change the behavior.
That is how you rebuild trust. It's not magic. It's a sustained demonstration of accountability.
Exactly. So let's do a quick student review here to distill the key takeaways from all these sources and examples.
Let's do it.
If we pull all these threads together, the standoff, the ego, the boundaries, the OWN method, the cohesive philosophy of this chapter becomes crystal clear. An apology is never about managing someone else's feelings.
Nope.
It is exclusively an accounting of your own actions. The moment you introduce an excuse, a defense, or the word but, you have stopped apologizing and started negotiating.
And you have to remember that excuses actually cause more long-term damage than the original mistake. A mistake's just an error in execution, all right? But an excuse is a deliberate evasion of truth. One can be forgiven. The other slowly rots the foundation of trust.
You are solely responsible for your actions. The other person is solely responsible for theirs. If you fully own your side of the street with a direct, specific apology, you give the other person the psychological safety they need to eventually own theirs.
But equally important is the boundary we discussed. If you are not in the wrong, do not issue a fake apology just to extinguish someone else's emotional fire. Every single interaction is a data point, training the people in your life how to treat you and what you value.
To truly internalize this operating system, to make it your default reaction under pressure, the chapter provides 3 lines of mental code.
Yes.
These are designed to rewrite your internal programming. I want you, the listener, to hear them exactly as they are written in the text. Could you read those for us?
Absolutely. First line, computer. My actions are mine. The other person's actions are theirs. Own my part completely.
Excellent.
Second line, computer. My reputation is built on what I take responsibility for, not what I excuse. And the third line, computer, being wrong is not weakness. Hiding from it is.
That is powerful stuff. If you want to dive deeper into these specific frameworks and find more resources on how to design a life built around extreme ownership and clarity, you can find more at jackslaws.com.
I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over. We've established that your word is essentially the only true asset you have in your relationships.
Right.
So ask yourself, what is the exchange rate of your, sorry.
Oh, I like that.
Is it backed by the gold standard of absolute accountability, or has it been inflated and devalued by years of excuses and deflections?
That is the ultimate question. Are you just slapping a cheap temporary patch on a blown tire, or are you doing the hard, vulnerable work of building a bridge that will actually last? Remember to check out jackslaws.com for more tools to build that bridge. Keep your apologies clean, drop the excuses, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.